Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Good morning. Welcome to Radioactivity. I'm Rob Lori. Coming up on the first part of today's program, we're going to hear a talk by economist Stephanie Kelton. It's all about her thinking, modern monetary theory, that says that federal deficits don't really matter. We have a big debate in this country about federal deficits. The federal deficit is going up and up and up. We're going to hear Stephanie Kelton first, then we're going to talk with some local activists who are proponents of modern monetary theory after we hear from economist Stephanie Kelton here on WMNF in Tampa. She gave a speech last October at the State University of New York at Stony Brook, and we're going to hear the introduction right now.
In her talk, Professor Kelton will cast a different light on the ongoing feuds over the budget deficit, arguing that Democrats and Republicans are both missing the bigger picture when it comes to paying for our future. Matt Bosler of Bloomberg recently noted that if you watch only one lecture on economics, it should be Dr. Kelton's take on the deficit. Well, this is your opportunity for that one lecture. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Stephanie Kelton to the stage.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you very much. Thank you, President Stanley, for the invitation to deliver a presidential lecture here at Stony Brook this year. I am very, very happy to be able to do this. And thank you to all of the staff and the many people who worked with me for the last month or so as we organized and planned for this event. So I'm going to jump right in. I only have about 20 minutes to get through some pretty weighty arguments, and so I'm going to try to do it with some levity. I hope this will be kind of a fun talk, but I hope that I can also be provocative and maybe get you to think about some pretty big questions in a way that maybe nobody has presented them before for you. So the big question is, how do we pay for it? It's really the trillion-dollar question. Whatever the agenda item is, whatever the policy proposal is, whether it's infrastructure or free college or Medicare for all or a Green New Deal, you get a politician who goes on a television show or sits down with a journalist and says, I've introduced legislation to do this thing. And the journalist responds by saying what? How are you going to pay for it? How are you going to pay for it? As if that's the most important question to begin with, right? You're not debating the merits of the proposal. Well, tell me about Medicare for All. What is it that you think is broken with our current healthcare delivery system? And why do you think moving to Medicare for All? Those aren't the conversations we end up having. It becomes the pay for question first, and then we get bogged down in whose taxes have to go up and by how much and all of that stuff, right? So we never end up having the really important debates because of this question. So why do we always start with this question? What's behind the question? Because there's an ideological framework behind that question. The question presupposes certain things, like, for example, that the government doesn't have the money to do these things. Where would the money come from, right? There's implicit in the question a concern about the budget, right? There's all this stuff behind that question. So we have to talk about that. And then I want to see whether it's possible for us as a nation to move beyond this question, to have better debates, to have better dialogue, to talk about the things that really matter and stop focusing always and everywhere on this one question: what is the impact on the deficit or the national debt going to be? How are we going to pay for it? So getting beyond the money question is the goal. Here's the problem. Okay, this is what, in a sense, we're up against in trying to get there. So this is a very short video. It's a couple of minutes, but it sets up the rest of the talk. So here we go.
Taking money from our children and borrowing from China.
To take out a credit card from the Bank of China in the name of our children, driving up our national debt that we are going to have to pay back. That's irresponsible. It's unpatriotic.
The government's irresponsible spending is turning us into slaves. You might well literally lock us into chains, at least our children.
We got to deal with this big long-term debt problem, or it will deal with us.
And it is a, I think it's a, I think it is They're innocent.
I'm asking you, join us to stop this fiscal train wreck. Join us to protect our children from an inferior standard of living, from a crushing burden of debt and taxes.
Okay, I don't believe in any of the tax cuts. I didn't want tax cuts for the rich. I didn't even want them from the middle class. Okay, because you know why? Because it puts a $400 billion hole in the budget and we just can't afford it.
And as we discuss deficit reduction, which is clearly a major issue.
For decades, we have piled deficit upon deficit, mortgaging our future and our children's future.
And the deficit thing is real and the debt thing is real. We are really in trouble on it at some point.
Is there need for comprehensive deficit reduction? The answer is not only yes, but hell yes.
This is debt that hangs over our head, a government that spends more money than it takes in. That's not sustainable.
No, you cannot cut taxes or increase spending unless you can pay for it.
The math of federal spending does not add up.
And we are spending money we do not have.
We have a debt burden. That's crushing us.
To me, this is more of a moral issue.
It is.
You can't steal from your kids and grandkids.
Deficit. We think the deficit and the national debt are at a moral level.
National debt is America's biggest problem.
Wow. Right? Bipartisan. If you watched the video, the way that it was put together, it essentially went Democrat, Republican, Democrat, Republican, Democrat, Republican. This is a bipartisan chorus when it comes to this issue. I know they say that Washington can't agree on anything. That's baloney. There is widespread agreement when it comes to the national debt and deficit spending. Right? Both parties, now they'll blame each other for who's responsible for having a national debt, but both of them, at least rhetorically, will tell you that this is a disaster for the nation, right? Bad things are going to happen as a result. And what I want to do is remind you that it's always been this way. Okay, this isn't new. The rhetoric isn't new. You saw Reagan, but it goes far back in history before Ronald Reagan. This is a cartoon from a newspaper in 1937. Okay, this is when, oh my God, the national debt is $36 billion with a B, billion dollars, right? High as a skyscraper, taller than Mount Everest and all that kind of stuff, right? So then from 1937, move through the 1940s, financing World War II, the national debt grows. All of a sudden, it's $49 billion with an expectation we're going up to $65 billion. Oh, the water's fine, don't worry, right? It's all a big joke. Gloom and doom. Ronald Reagan finishes and they erect a monument in this cartoon. This is Reagan's legacy, $1.5 trillion, now with a T. And then $3 trillion. And then when Clinton leaves office, $5.7 trillion. And then it's $7.5 trillion. And then it's up to $9. And then $10. And then $13. $14. The poor child. $15. It's eating through the country. $16 trillion. The monsters are upon us. $17 trillion. The Democrats and Republicans are kicking the can down the curb. $17 trillion rolling in on our children and grandchildren. $18 trillion now so big it no longer fits on Earth. It is an interstellar problem. $18 trillion. $19 trillion, a cancer on America. $20 trillion, the Titanic catastrophe ahead. And where we are today, gross national debt, $21 trillion. All along the way, year after year after year, the debt continues to grow. The cartoonists, the pundits, the warnings, the hysteria, it's always been with us. It's always been with us. Okay, the sky is always falling. And so what I would like this afternoon to be is essentially a form of group therapy, because we need it, okay? Because they're scaring us with these stories about how it's unpatriotic, how it's burdening the next generation, how it's dooming us to a future of higher taxes, catastrophe for the nation, right? And I want to try to lower the temperature, get us to the point where we can, at whatever age it's legal to do so, open a nice bottle of red wine, read the newspaper, see the headline, national debt is at an all-time high, and have that nice glow about us and feel at peace with the world, right? There's no reason to panic, and I'll try to walk you through how I think we should be looking at some of these things. But it does require a change in the way we think.
You're listening to economist Stephanie Kelton on Modern Monetary Theory here on WMNF in Tampa, 88.5 FM.
Paradigm shift, right? We have to begin to see these things not as problems, but in a different light. And so that's what I want to try to do. I think the biggest mistake that we make is thinking of the federal government like a household. It's that household analogy. It's the idea that Uncle Sam is just like one of us, right? The federal government operates like a household. I have a budget. I have a budget constraint. I can't spend more than I make year after year. I can't continue to take on more and more debt and end up okay at the end of the day. Therefore, the federal government can't do that either, right? I analogize from my individual personal household to the nation as a whole, and I say, if I can't do it, they can't do it. If it's bad for me, it's bad for everyone, right? The government's budget is nothing like a household budget. This is the problem. They're not like us. Their budget doesn't work the way our budgets work. Deficit spending by the federal government isn't the same as you and I spending more than we make year after year. Borrowing by the federal government isn't the same as you and I going out and putting money on a credit card. One of us issues the currency. They do. The other one of us, you and I, are merely using the US dollar. So we have a distinction to make between currency issuers and currency users. The issuer of the currency, the federal government in this case, can never run out of it, can never go broke, can never have bills coming due that it can't afford to pay, can't become insolvent, can't end up like people you may know, right, who took on too much debt and got into trouble and were forced into bankruptcy. So this is the biggest hurdle, is getting beyond thinking of the government as a household, like, you know, personalizing it. So I want to try, in the time that remains, to tackle five big questions. I'm going to try to do it in close to 5 minutes. It's going to take a little bit longer. But these are the five big questions that I want us to look at. First, what is the deficit? Most people who have very strong emotional reactions to the idea of a government deficit can't tell you what it is. Okay, so we want to talk about that. Same thing goes with the national debt. In fact, people often conflate the two, the deficit and the debt. So what is this deficit? What is the national debt? What is this obsession with China? You heard it again and again, borrowing from China. Take out a credit card and Bank of China in the name of our children. China, China, China. So let's talk about China. Don't we eventually have to pay it back? And if 21 trillion becomes 22, then 23, then 25, then 30, then how are we ever going to retire this thing, right? Do we have to eventually pay it back? And then the question, which is what I organized the talk around, what can we afford, right? What can we afford? If we have all of these ambitious things that we as a nation might like to do, if there's broad support for programs for repairing and rebuilding crumbling infrastructure, do we have the resources to do it? And how do we pay for it? What can we afford to do? Okay, so those are the five big questions. The first one is the deficit question. What is the deficit? So I want us to suppose that I'm the federal government, and I'm going to spend 10 of these into the economy, and you're going to be my economy. So I'm going to spend these 10 into the economy, and this handsome young man, my husband, is going to take these 10, right? And so I just spent 10 into the economy. So there they are, right? They're there and they're here with him. But now I'm the government, so I'm going to tax some of those away. So give me back 4. I'm going to take 4. 1, 2, 3, 4. Okay. Thank you for participating. I have taxed away 4. Okay? So this is a government deficit. That's what the deficit is. It means the government spends more into the economy than it taxes back out. So I did this thing called deficit spending. And my record, my budget, is going to record a deficit. -6, right? That is my deficit. But guess what? The economy has a record as well. And the economy's record is going to show what? +6. Show me that 6. There it is. It's real. That's the surplus that was created as a result of my deficit spending. So my deficit, my red ink, is your black ink. Okay, here it is with actual historical data for the US going back to 1960. The red line is my account balance. Okay, the red line is my financial balance. The black line is the private sector in the US. It's all the households, it's all the businesses in the US combined. And what do you notice? I'm almost always in the red. My budget is almost always in deficit, and yours is almost always in surplus. And not only that, they tend to move opposite one another, meaning when I run bigger deficits, you all end up with bigger surpluses, okay? So my red ink is your black ink. So when you see a headline like this one, right, from the Wall Street Journal just a few days ago, trillion-dollar deficits could be the new normal. This is meant to shock and frighten. Trillion-dollar deficits could be the new normal. But take a breath and read it this way. Watch the word deficit. Don't you feel better? Don't you feel better? Trillion-dollar surpluses could be the new normal. Oh, all right. I'm down. I'm okay, right? Maybe that's not a bad thing, is what I'm suggesting. Look at the problem, or is it a problem, from a different angle. Okay, I see a surplus. I see a deficit. Well, stand over here, right? Because if you see a deficit, you're looking at it from the perspective of the federal government. But look at it from your perspective. You're in the private sector. If you look at it from your perspective, you don't see the deficit, you see the surplus, okay? Because that's what's accumulating as a result. So, whoops, want to back up just one. So now let's talk about, we know what the deficit is. We know that my deficits become your financial surpluses. Let's talk about the national debt. What is the national debt? So remember, I ran this thing called a budget deficit. I spent 10 into the economy. I only taxed 4 back. I left him with 6. But when I run deficits, I borrow. Okay, that's how the federal government currently does things. And so if I deficit spend 6, then I borrow 6. So I've got 6 of these things. Yes, I do. 6 of these things. And I'm going to sell him these things called treasury bonds. So he's going to give me the money that I gave him, and I'm going to give him the treasury bonds. So that cash now is gone, and we have swapped it for treasury bonds. And that's what the national debt is. The national debt is all of the outstanding treasury bonds that the government spent the money into the economy, didn't tax it back, and then traded the cash for a different financial instrument called a security, a government bond. Okay? So the entire national debt is nothing more than a record, a historical record, of all of the dollars that were spent into the economy, not taxed back, and are currently being held in the form of U.S. Treasuries. That's all the national debt is. All right, so if you happen to hold some of those things, they're your assets. They're in your portfolio. If you're an investor, you might have some of those things. Okay, they're very nice to have. They're safe. They're liquid. They're default risk-free. They help you diversify your portfolio. You can take risks elsewhere, but you can hold some treasuries, right? And they pay interest. And so if you see this clock up here, I took a snapshot yesterday. So this thing runs in real time, and it's meant to scare people, right? The national debt, tick, 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 tick. Those numbers just keep getting bigger and bigger and bigger. Well, look, now that you know what the national debt is, nothing more than the historical record of all of the dollars that were spent into the economy and not taxed back, currently being held in the form of treasury securities, you can look at that debt clock and watch the name. It becomes the U.S. dollar savings clock. So now we don't have to get so anxious because it doesn't have the word debt any longer. Now we know it's just an asset clock. Okay, it's recording all of the dollars that are currently being held in the form of treasuries as somebody's savings. So now don't you feel better? Okay, see, I see smiles and heads nodding. So we're already making progress in group therapy. Number 3, China. What are we going to do with China? So here's the question people say. I know China holds so much of our debt, though. And then they just leave it there as if that's supposed to automatically explain why that's a bad thing. Say, so okay, China holds some U.S. treasuries, about a trillion currently. So where did they get them? Where did China get U.S. treasuries? So I'm going to show you. So China, I would like to buy some of the things that are made in China. Okay, and I'm gonna pay with US dollars. This is my daughter. She plays with these. They're squishies. They're made in China. So we import things from China. They manufacture, they put on containers, they ship to us, we get them, we import them, they export them to us. We pay with dollars. So I have the stuff, right? China's people, the Chinese are working in factories, manufacturing, giving their time, using their resources, producing this stuff. They don't keep and consume and enjoy for themselves. They ship it to us, and we pay with dollars. So now China has a checking account at the Federal Reserve. Okay, they have dollars in their account at a bank here in the U.S. called the Fed. So now China has a decision to make. I can sit and hold my dollars in my checking account, or I can spend them, right? I could buy some of the stuff the U.S. manufacturers. I could buy real estate or other things priced in dollars, or I could buy treasuries, because treasuries pay interest. So maybe I don't want to keep my dollars in a checking account. Maybe I would prefer to transfer my dollars into a savings account, which is nothing more than a securities account at the Fed. So this is borrowing from China, watch. I'm borrowing from China. There, I did it. I borrowed from China. Okay, now China has the treasury bond. I have the stuff, and I've borrowed from China. Okay, that's what borrowing from China means. So the question then becomes, what if they won't buy our bonds any longer? What if they, because we think that somehow everything is made in China, including the US dollar, and to get more dollars to spend, we need China, right? No, we don't.
You're listening to economist Stephanie Kelton talk about modern monetary theory. In just a few minutes, we're going to open up the phone lines. You're listening to WMNF in Tampa, 88.5 FM. Stephanie Kelton is giving this talk at Stony Brook, the SUNY University in New York.
Okay, so what if China decides, I don't want to buy treasuries anymore? Well, that's perfectly fine. China could decide to just keep their dollars in their checking account at the Fed. It'd be kind of silly to give up the interest, but, you know, they could decide to do that. Would that harm the U.S.? Would it prevent us from, you know, being able to finance other projects, infrastructure, and so forth? The answer is no. Okay, I think we're going to get to explore that a little bit more maybe in the Q&A, but I just want to give it away. Here is Secretary Mnuchin, Treasury Secretary, just the other day in Reuters article. This is just from 3 days ago. Mnuchin is asked, are you worried about China refusing to buy treasuries and so forth? He says, I don't lose any sleep over it. Okay, and he's right not to. What do we really owe China? So I have a friend who's a bond trader. He's a fixed income guy, trades government bonds. And his name is Warren Mosler. And Warren will often say, the only thing we owe China is a bank statement. Okay, he's being a little bit funny, but essentially at the end of the day, that's about it. Okay, what do we owe China? A bank statement. Okay, we already got the stuff. We traded it for a treasury. And at the end of the day, as long as China wants to orient its economy around exporting in order to grow, in order to create jobs, then we're the beneficiary in this bargain, right? And we can talk, as I said, we can talk more about that. So there are politics involved in all of this, and look, when it comes to the national debt, both sides do this, and the deficit too. You blew up the national debt. You did this bad thing that added to deficits. The Democrats are doing it to the Republicans now because of the tax cuts that were recently passed, right? You added to the national debt, you blew up deficits and all this kind of stuff. When the shoe is on the other foot, the Republicans do the same thing to the Democrats. So it is, again, it's both sides pointing fingers. When I was working on the Hill in the Senate, one of my favorite things to do was to ask elected officials or their staffers, if you had a magic wand, and you could wave the magic wand and eliminate the national debt tomorrow, would you do it? Everyone said, what do you think? Of course. Yes, I would eliminate the national debt with my magic wand, no hesitation whatsoever. And I say, okay, what if I give you a different wand? And I ask you if you would like to, you can wave this magic wand and you can eliminate U.S. treasuries. They'll just be gone from the face of the earth tomorrow. How many people do you think would wave the wand? How many members of the Senate would wave the wand to eradicate the world of treasury securities? And you just get a total look of Like, why are you, I don't understand the question. You say, that's okay, you already answered it, right? Eliminating the national debt means eliminating all of those safe securities called U.S. Treasuries that people like to hold in their portfolios, because that's what the national debt is. You pay off the debt, you eliminate the debt, there are no more Treasury securities anywhere. They're done. All right, so here is a historical lesson. There have been seven times in our nation's history when we have, when the government has begun to run budget surpluses and pay down the debt. Seven times in our nation's history. We did it from 1817 to 1821. The federal government's budget was in surplus. It's collecting more in taxes than it's putting back into the economy by spending. And so the national debt is being paid down. And we did it for a period of time. What happened? Had a depression that started in 1819. We did it again from 1823 to 1836 under Andrew Jackson. Actually paid off the national debt. What happened? Depression in 1837. Then we did it again. Began to pay down the national debt. Depression. Not recession. Depression. Deep, protracted, right? Contraction in the economy. Bad situation. The last time we did it was under President Bill Clinton, 98 through 2001. The budget was in surplus. The government began to pay down the debt. What happened? The economy went into recession in 2001, and we ended up with a Great Recession just a handful of years later. So why does that happen? Why does something that sounds so good and fiscally responsible, running some budget surpluses and paying down debt, why does it tend to coincide with bad economic consequences? Why do we end up with depressions and the Great Recession? And very quickly, because we could talk for an hour just about, I could, about this picture. But I want to just show you, this is where we were with Bill Clinton. That is the government's budget moving into surplus. You can see the red. That's the government's deficit. Government's almost always in deficit. But there were those 4 years right there under Bill Clinton when the government's budget moved into surplus. And there was great celebration, right? This is the first time in generations that the budget has been in surplus. This is the fiscally responsible thing to do. You know, Democrats delivered this. Well, yeah, but guess what? Look what happened to the private sector's financial position. Right? It was built on the backs of the private sector. The private sector's financial balance went deeply in the red, and that's what allowed the public sector's balance to move temporarily into the black. But it didn't last, and it can't last. Why? Because it was driven by primarily households spending more than their income, borrowing on the back of a dot-com bubble and then a housing bubble, and eventually the whole thing unravels. Too much debt, mostly for households, okay? And so it's unsustainable when the private sector does it, with households driving, but it's perfectly sustainable for the federal government's budget to remain in deficit for a period of decades. So last question here, what can we afford? This is how we think government spending works. We think that the government is broke. We think that they need our money. We think that they come first to us, either to tax or to borrow, the TAB, taxing and borrowing. That the government raises revenue by taxing us and by borrowing money, then it has money that it can then spend into the economy. So the fight is always who's going to pick up the tab, who's going to pay for it, because the financing has to come from somewhere. The money has to come from somewhere, and it will be the taxpayers or it will be borrowing, which is the same as saying deficit spending, which is the same as saying putting it on the credit card, adding to the debt. Okay, because this is how we think this is how it's supposed to work. And so the fights are all about who's going to pay for it. Whose taxes are going to go up? Who's going to be paying for it, right? So you get somebody like Senator Sanders, who put forward an ambitious economic platform, right? Wants to do $1 trillion of infrastructure, wants to make public colleges and universities tuition free, wants to transition to a healthcare system based on, built around Medicare for all, wants to be in it. You've heard, right? This ambitious program. And his opponent in the Democratic primary, you know, kind of in her book, this is from her book, What Happened, she says, you know, it was like every time we tried to offer something, he offered something bigger. And it was like, you know, hey, I think, you know, Bernie's saying, I think America should get a pony. And Hillary says, how are you going to pay for the pony? Because it's all so fantastical. It's so out of reach. It's a pony, right? It's not realistic. So in D.C., where I worked on the budget committee, there is a great deal of pressure to pay for things. There is a lot of pressure for people, especially when they're running for president, to show that they have the money to make good on whatever policies they're putting forward. So if you say you're going to make public colleges and universities tuition-free, somebody wants you to draw a line to the source of revenue. Where's the money coming from? And so Senator Sanders did that. And he said, well, we'll pay for it with a tax on Wall Street speculation, a financial transactions tax. Wall Street will pay for it. He did it with infrastructure and with other programs. When he said, well, we'll close tax loopholes, or we'll have, you know, raise the cap on FICA withholdings, and we'll fine the billionaires and corporations, and the rich will pay for it, right? When we talk about the wall, President Trump did the same thing. Mexico will pay for it, right? The money has to come from somewhere, and so everybody's trying to pay for it. So here's where I wish we were, and this is very close to the end. Where I wish we were was having an entirely different conversation and a very different national debate. And if I had a little bit more time, I would show you this video clip, but I've seen it so many times, I'm just going to tell you what it does. So that is Alan Greenspan, who was chairman of the Federal Reserve for a period of time before Ben Bernanke, right? You may remember. So here's Alan Greenspan under oath before Congress, answering a question from Congressman Paul Ryan. And Paul Ryan is asking him a question about Social Security, because whenever these discussions and debates come up about the national debt and our budget picture, national budget, people say it's entitlements that are the problem. It's Medicare, it's Social Security, it's Medicaid. These are the real drivers of our long-term fiscal crisis or challenge, right? They point to entitlements. So here's Greenspan sitting there under oath, and he's asked this question by Congressman Paul Ryan. Don't you agree with me that now is the time to begin to move toward a system of personal retirement accounts? This is privatizing Social Security. Now is the time to begin to transition to a system of personal retirement accounts, because we all know Social Security is going broke and we can't afford to make good on promises. Okay, that's what Ryan asked Greenspan. And Greenspan said, no, I don't agree with you. I don't agree with you at all. And then he goes on to say, and the quote is here, all right, so the first part is here. There's nothing to prevent the federal government from creating as much money as it wants and paying it to someone. Whoa. When did anybody ever go on TV and tell you that? Right? There's nothing to prevent the federal government from creating as much money as it wants to and paying it to someone. So he has completely taken the affordability question off the table.
You're listening to a lecture on modern monetary theory from economist Stephanie Kelton. In just a moment, we'll open up the phone lines. You can comment about this by sending an email to us here at the studio at dj@wmnf.org. This is 88.5 FM. Here's more of Stephanie Kelton.
We don't have to ask whether we can make good on promises to future retirees, their dependents, and the disabled. We can. We can make good on every promise in perpetuity. Nothing to stop us from doing that. Then he goes on to make the really important point that we should be having an entire national debate around. And his next sentence is this. The question is, how do you set up a system which assures that the real assets are created, which those benefits are employed to purchase? What does that mean? It means that we have demographic changes taking place in this country. More and more people who are today working are going to be moving into retirement this year, next year, the following year, the boomers, right? They're already leaving the labor force and moving into retirement, and that's going to continue for some time. And it's going to leave behind fewer and fewer people who are working and producing the stuff, But the boomers, once they retire, they don't stop consuming. They continue to consume. They just stop helping us to produce the stuff. So Greenspan's point is, how do you set up a system which assures that the real assets, the stuff, is created so that when those benefit payments go out to future retirees, their dependents, and the disabled, they can do what? Spend that money into an economy that is productive enough, there's enough stuff being produced that we don't get what kind of a problem? Inflation, I heard it. Because if the economy is not productive enough 5 years, 10 years, 20 years, 30 years from now, and the checks go out, then we're all going to be competing for a smaller and smaller quantity of actual stuff. And we're going to create an inflation problem. And inflation is every central banker's public enemy number one. That's what he's worried about. Okay? So can you imagine if instead of saying Social Security is going broke, we have to cut benefits, the system is unsustainable, forget all of that. If instead of that, we were saying, what are the things that we can do today? What are the investments we can make today to increase the odds that in 5, 10, 20 years, the U.S. economy is productive enough that we can make good on all of those promises without causing an inflation problem? The Republicans would say what? Tax cuts and deregulation are the best ways to produce an economy that is, you know, maximum growth and high productivity. And the Democrats would say what? Education, infrastructure, R&D, but at least we would be having the right debate, right? At least we would be having a good, constructive, productive debate over the real issues that matter instead of this phony, you know, where the money is running out sort of debate. So that's where I wish we were. The U.S. government is never going to run out of the U.S. dollar. The U.S. government is the scorekeeper for the dollar. It can't run out of dollars any more than a carpenter can run out of inches, or the scorekeeper here at Stony Brook can run out of points when the football team is putting up 77 points in a game, and all the fans are sitting in the audience going, oh my God, what happens if they score again? They're never going to have enough points to put up. Yes, they will. They can't run out. The stadium can't run out of points. The U.S. government can't run out of dollars. It's a unit, right? The government spends by instructing its bank to change the numbers in someone's account upward. That's how we pay for things. It's not actually by physically printing money and making payments. It's all done electronically, okay? So that's how it really works. The spending comes first. Congress authorizes a budget. That's how it's supposed to work. The House and the Senate write a budget. There's budget resolution. The president signs the budget. And there's authorization is given, right? Budgetary authorization comes through appropriations. And the agencies are told, this is how much money you have to spend. And the government begins spending, right? The spending happens first, and once people receive income from the government's spending, people start paying taxes, and now there's money to also buy those bonds. Remember, I spent it before I taxed it back or sold the bonds. So this is from a series of talks I gave just over this summer in London, one at the British Public Library and one in the House of Lords. This is the debate I wish we were having. Instead of getting bogged down in the pay-for question, focus on the real things that matter. What can we afford? The answer isn't in financial terms. The answer is in real terms. If we want to do $1 trillion of infrastructure and somebody says, how are you going to pay for it? You should say, I'm going to pay for it by hiring 300,000 construction workers, by using X tons of steel, by using 2 or 3% of our unused spare capacity in our factories, by mobilizing this many machines and heavy equipment. And so that's how you pay for it. Real resources. And if you don't have them, if the economy is already operating at full employment and everybody's being used, all the workers are already employed, all the resources are currently being used, then you can't afford it, right? But if you have spare capacity, if you have idle people, if you have idle machines, if the raw materials are there, then the government can step in and say, now would be a good time because we can mobilize these resources in a responsible way. That means without causing inflation, without competing for those resources with other people who are currently using. They're not being used. We can hire them, put them to work, and improve the standard of living, right, in the interest of the public good. So thank you very much.
So thank you so much.
Well, that was Stephanie Kelton, who's an economist, teaches at Stony Brook, the State University of New York at Stony Brook. She's been an advisor to Bernie Sanders, and her theory is called the Modern Monetary Theory. And you're listening to WMNF in Tampa, 88.5 FM. We're going to bring on two advocates of the theory who are local activists, Scott Ferguson and Brian Schatz. And Scott and Brian, welcome to WMNF. Good to have you here.
Good to be here.
Thanks for having
us. So tell me, what does it mean to be an activist on modern monetary theory? What do you guys actually do to kind of promote Kelton's ideas?
Well, we do a lot of things. I mean, I'm a scholar, I'm a professor, I'm a teacher, so I teach it, and I teach it in my cultural studies courses at the University of South Florida. I also co-direct a nonprofit organization. It's called the Modern Money Network, and we're there to put on events and further the research project of modern monetary theory in interdisciplinary ways. You can find us online at themodernmoneynetwork.org. I also, through the Modern Money Network, host a podcast called Money on the Left, and you can find that at Buzzsprout, iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, and other places you get your podcasts.
All right. It almost sounds too good to be true.
Ponies.
But, yeah, we all want a pony. Yeah. Tell us more about why you think this kind of economic system is possible.
It frees up the left, especially if you're a progressive. This allows you to think in terms of, we can afford all of these programs as long as the productive capacity of our workforce and real resources are available. So when people who are on the left get stuck and try to cut spending somewhere else to afford something else, you know, we just went through PAYGO and all that other, I call it malarkey, and we need to not think that way. We need to tell our politicians, our federal ones, we know how this works, and we want you to act for us for the public purpose.
And that old question about government spending creating inflation goes to your point that as long as there's the productive capacity in society that's unused, whether it's an unused human being, an unemployed human being, or an underperforming factory, that as long if you put money into that, then the money in government actually grows because...
Absolutely. As Stephanie Kelton likes to say, the economy has a speed limit, and the government and fiscal policy has to respect that speed limit, and it can't grow too quickly and outpace productive capacities. Something else I'd like to bring up is that the way we talk about inflation in this country is highly coded. So when we talk about programs for women, people of color, to fight climate change, suddenly the fiscal deficit and the debt become a problem, and at the same time, inflation and potential hyperinflation becomes a problem. When we invade Iraq, when we give corporate subsidies, when we grow a financial sector which is arguably hyperinflationary, going through cycles of asset bubbles, we never talk about blowing holes through budgets. We never talk about hyperinflation.
We just during Hurricane Michael, some F-22s were destroyed. Each one cost $300 million. Nobody's raised that as an issue, to your point, that people just kind of say, oh, a $300 million airplane, okay, it's gone. Mm-hmm, and nobody complains.
Yeah, we also don't talk about rising prices in healthcare, education, basic things that Americans need every day. We don't call that out of control inflation. But I'll tell you what, if I had to pay for college fees today, and all I had was an old wheelbarrow like they did during Weimar Germany, and I had to stack up U.S. dollars to meet my payments for college, I would look a lot like they did in Weimar Germany.
Well, we're talking about modern monetary theory with two local proponents. We just heard a talk from economist Stephanie Kelton, who's perhaps the major proponent of modern monetary theory in the country. She has been an advisor to Bernie Sanders. Has she advised other politicians? Has she worked with other?
Yeah, absolutely. I think some on and off the record. Most recently, there have been on and off talks with the new Congresswoman from Queens, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez.
That's right.
And there's been a lot of excitement and from the right, anxiety about this burgeoning relationship between AOC and MMT.
And even, you remember back in 2000, Howard Dean, he had a breakfast and he talked about it on Twitter, and he says, Stephanie Kelton makes a lot of sense, so he's becoming a believer.
All right, let's take some phone calls. Our phone number is 813-239-9663, and our email address is dj@wmnf.org. Would this work only for the U.S. government because we're such a powerful government? I mean, what could a developing nation just kind of print money willy-nilly, build all of its infrastructure up, without causing inflation or, problems, economic problems for the country?
It's a great question. It works for any economy, but there are several things that we have to qualify here. One is MMT will stress that a government needs to have full monetary sovereignty, full control over their fiscal capacity, and they need to be issuing debts denominated in their own unit of account. So if their economy is dependent on a foreign unit of account, let's say the US dollar, then a developing country is going to be in trouble. And so very often what this does is it fuels a system of export-led growth where labor and resources are being extracted from a post-colonial country, and they don't have the productive infrastructure capacity in order to create goods and services for themselves. So yes, fiscal policy can and should be used to serve the public purpose in those places, but you can't do it too quickly. Right, and you have to do it in very deliberate ways, working to sustain a level of food sovereignty and also energy sovereignty.
Those are the two key: food, energy. Both of those, if you're sovereign in that regard, yes, you can answer that question. Yes, you can pay for those things. When you don't, when you take Venezuela importing most of their food, they're in trouble.
Well, we're talking about modern monetary theory with two local activists who advocate it, Scott Ferguson and Brian Schatz are here. And Scott, you're going to be doing a public event sometime in the next few days. Where is the event?
I am. It's at 7 p.m. on January 31st, this Thursday, for the Progressive Democratic Caucus of Tampa Bay. They've invited me to give essentially my own version of the intro to MMT talk. They've titled it Burningomics 101, and it's at the local Seminole Heights branch of the library.
In Tampa. All right. Yeah. Let's go to our first question from Frederico in Clearwater. Frederico, you're on WMNF. Do you have a question for our guests?
Well, actually, what I want to say is that this lady, the economist, is certifiable insane. This is not modern monetary theory. This is Keynesian monetary theory. It's only one side of the monetary theory. And also, we are the only country on Earth that can get away with printing an infinite amount of dollars because all countries can take the money because it's the world's currency. But this theory applied to any other situation will go into inflation, deficit, bankruptcy, and hunger, like it happened in Venezuela, by the way. Chavez had the same idea, and look where Venezuela is today. 20% of the population has fled the country on foot. So what Bernie Sanders and this lady are trying to sell is the idea that the government can print an endless amount of money, and somehow everything will work out and we'll be happy. And, you know, we basically, by printing money, we'll be richer, which is not true. And that's what the other side of economic theory is saying.
So all right.
Basically, well, what you're selling, this program is socialism. Are you really a communist, or what is going on here?
All right, Frederico, thank you. Thank you for your call. So what would you say back to Frederico?
Wow, there's a lot going on there. Very familiar anxieties and critiques. I guess the first question would be, am I a socialist? Yes. Moving on. The next question is about printing money. And that this is insane. Like, this is lunacy. So first of all, Most of the main central bankers of the last God knows how long would admit this, right? They're never going to go on record like Alan Greenspan did and say the U.S. government can run out of money because they know that's not true. Okay, so that's not insanity. That's just the status quo. Also, this expression "printing money" is—it's a misnomer, and right. It's very misleading. Because first of all, we're talking about all money comes from the U.S. government. It is so-called printed, but in fact, most of it is not printed. Most of it is just punched up on computers. A very small amount of our so-called money supply comes in the form of printing dollar bills or minting coins. So, really, to use the U.S. dollar. You know, I bought a soda before I came here. I had money. It had to be made. It had to be created. It's constantly being created. So the idea that money isn't constantly being created and that somehow fiscal policy is some radical exception to what the status quo is just false.
There is an interesting part in that interview that we played where Stephanie Kelton says that every time the federal government has begun to pay down the national debt, it's led to a depression. And unfortunately, because we were not on TV, we weren't able to show the video of that. But she does have charts that claim that, which is a really powerful part of her presentation.
Yeah, if you were to see the chart and you'd look at sort of a mountain range, it's actually a mirror image as though you're looking at a water image of the mountain range. So when lots and lots of spending by the federal government is happening, there's lots of money in the private sector. And when you balance the budget, you're actually removing the private sector's ability to fund itself. So she made that point of there's 4 years in the Clinton administration that basically delivered a 2001 recession for George W. Bush.
I mean, she's basically making the point that the more money overall you put into the economy, whether it's tax cuts or whether it's spending on infrastructure or healthcare or education, the more money you put into the economy, as long as it's productive,
right,
it won't cause inflation and it'll create a better economy.
Absolutely. And I think the bigger point here is another sharper critique of free market neoliberalism and libertarianism, which is that the federal government is always there helping us out. Right now, it's helping out the military-industrial complex, the prison-industrial complex, Walmart, and all kinds of other folks that we don't want them helping out. But they're there.
But the downside is, and it gets to Frederico's point, is that really no other nation outside the U.S. could do this because the dollar is like the thing that everybody relies on. Well, okay, Brian, you're shaking your head no. But what other countries even tried to do this successfully?
As long as you're monetarily sovereign, which Canada, Japan, Australia, England, on, as long as you have your own dollar and you tax it back, you can certainly do these things. And they are doing it right now. By the way, modern monetary theory.
So you're saying that they pay everything that the citizenry wants on infrastructure, healthcare, education?
Oh, no, they have austerity problems as well. This brings us to, it's probably a subject I'd love for you, Rob, to take on. So in 1947, there was a pushback on FDR, and it was serious. So these economists got together and created the society, the Mont Pelerin Society.
Yeah, FDR was dead by then, but anyway,
yeah.
Go ahead. Yeah, he was dead in 45. Yeah,
yeah. But they hated what he did.
Yeah,
he had, in 1944, the tax rate was 94%. He wanted it at 100. They hated him. So these folks, Hayek, von Mises, Buchanan, you know, Popper, Milton Friedman, they created this society to try to tear it down and change people's minds. They've actually won. The breadcrumbs that come from that actual organization are all the right-wing talk media, you know, the Heritage Foundation, all of those folks come from that society. And what really puzzles me and makes me sort of sad is the lefties believe this stuff.
We're down to the last minute, and we're talking with Brian Schatz and Scott Ferguson. Scott, you're going to be speaking at the Seminole Heights Library in Tampa January 31st at 7 p.m.?
Correct.
All right. And what's the other best way to get in touch with you two local activists on this modern monetary theory?
We'd certainly love for those who do Facebook to look up the Facebook page MMT Tampa Bay and let's have a dialogue. I'm looking for more people in the Tampa Bay area to get together, and I would like for us to all get together and spread the word.
And if you want to see Stephanie Kelton's speech, I will send you a copy of the speech. Just email me here in the studio at dj@wmnf.org. Scott and Brian, thanks a lot for coming by WMNF and discussing modern monetary theory.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
And if you want to comment about today's show, please call us up at 813-238-8001. Record your comment on extension 115. And I'll play your comments back tomorrow at 11 o'clock. Tomorrow, Jane Castor, one of the candidates for mayor, will be here. We'll be talking about why she wants to be the next mayor of Tampa. This is 88.5 FM WMNF, Tampa, St. Petersburg. Thanks to Jan Simpson. She's been our phone producer today. Now we go up to Washington, D.C. for the latest news from NPR. And then right after that, your hero, Mark Biro, will be in the studio hosting the Midpoint program here on WMNF